Hi Jane.
Hi, Tom.
Hi
Hello.
Jane, you okay?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thank you. I hope you've got your big cup of coffee or tea or whatever, because it's very early over there in Australia, Melbourne. We really appreciate you coming on.
You're very welcome. I've got a big cup of tea in front of me. It's still dark outside. So, yeah.
Oh, bless you. Oh, we're going to be really kind to you. We'll look after you, and we really look forward to this evening or this morning, afternoon, wherever everyone else is in the world. We're very fortunate to have you on, and it's a real honor that you've come on to connect with the community tonight. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're really welcome.
So,
I'm honoured that you invited me. Thank you.
oh, bless you, bless you. So let's get into tonight's guest speaker. We're going to have a chat with Jane. She is the Foundation Director for Australia Centre for Behavioural Research in Diabetes. Jane has a PhD in health psychology and is a chartered psychologist. Jane leads a large and varied programme of research in Australia and aims to improve the quality of life and self-care of people with diabetes. And some of Jane's principal research interests include enhancing diabetes care, hypoglycemia, behavioural change, social stigmas and language, and the overall quality of life. So we've got so many fantastic things to chat about tonight, Jane. You are on speaker with myself, my co-host Morgan, Chris, and Dawny is on speaker as well. If anyone wants to come on at any point and talk with Jane and ask questions, we can do that, or hashtag diabetes chat. Let's get into it, Jane. So when you left school or in the early days, did you always want to be a psychologist? And did you want to work in diabetes? And how did that all come about?
Gosh, a big question going back a long time. So when I was at school in England, finishing like doing my A levels, there was no psychology A level available at our school. But I did start reading psychology magazines, and I was finding the area fascinating. So I decided that I would do a degree in psychology. I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do with it. I think at the time I was really quite interested in advertising, and the whole, how do we sell things to people kind of route. But I fairly quickly got disillusioned by that idea. And it wasn't until, and I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do with it. A lot of my friends who were on the course were into clinical psychology. It wasn't really for me. And then I started to hear about this area called health psychology, which was pretty new at that stage. So, I mean, I was starting my degree in 1989. I think health psychology in the UK had only been around for a couple of years before that. So by the time I was sort of midway into my degree, it was still very new. But in my final year of my degree, I was able to do a module in health psychology, and it really started to fascinate me. What helps people to stay well? What is it about their thinking and how they're feeling that enables people to cope with chronic conditions like diabetes, or other issues? How do we, keep the general population as healthy and well as possible? Sort of all the health promotion aspects of health psychology. And it was, I think, fair to say that when I did a work placement just before the end of my degree in a hospital, and for my thesis, I did research into the communication of the decision not to resuscitate people. And that was absolutely fascinating to me that health professionals were not communicating this well amongst themselves. They certainly weren't communicating these decisions or having appropriate discussions at an appropriate time, not only with the person who might not be resuscitated, but also with their family members. And so you can see some of the parallels here that I'm starting to draw out with things that go on in diabetes. And so that whole area was really interesting to me. But I didn't get into diabetes until a few years later. I actually went for a PhD in the area of cancer and didn't get it. And at the time, I was very upset about that. But it was probably one of the best things that ever happened, really, because it made me realize I needed more research experience before I did a PhD. And so I went to work with Claire Bradley at Royal Holloway, University of London, and she was specializing in diabetes at the time. And I got hooked on the area pretty much straight away. I just found it really interesting that so many different types of diabetes, different ways of managing it. It affects people at all ages and stages of life. And my research was looking into the impact of diabetes on quality of life. And yeah, I found that really interesting to see all the different ways in which diabetes could affect someone. And the fact that that wasn't really being recognized by health professionals at the time was equally fascinating to me. So that's probably my little potted history of how I got into diabetes psychology.
No, that's great. That's great. And what about your sort of jobs? And obviously, we're going to talk about your role as director at ACBRD. But before that, could you maybe tell us a bit about your journey to get to that point? And then Morgan's going to go into a few questions about what you're doing now.
So as I say, at Royal Holloway, I ended up doing my PhD there, and it was in diabetes. So I was investigating how we assess or how we measure diabetes knowledge. And there were so many aspects to that that it was quite unbelievable to me. And also the impact on quality of life. After that, I actually went to work in a contract research organisation. So having specialised, if you like, during my PhD in how do we develop questionnaires to assess various concepts, invalid and reliable ways, then a job came up that was working with the pharmaceutical industry to help them to dis determine which questionnaires to put into their clinical trials to assess outcomes. And I just thought, well, that's, I've been trained to do that, so I should go and have a look at that. So I did that for about a year, but fairly soon into that, I realized that it wasn't, I wasn't going to stay there forever. And one of the reasons for that was that even though the area was very interesting and I did enjoy the work with pharma companies to help them to understand various, medical conditions and their treatments from the perspective of the person living with those conditions. The thing for me was that I didn't really have autonomy over where the research would go. So we would be invited to, or required, if you like, to do a piece of work. We'd do that work, write up our report, write up some recommendations for where that needs to go in the future. And then we wouldn't be able to continue with that line of research. We'd need to just take the lead of the pharma company. And if they decided to drop that area, or if they decided that, another thing over here was more interesting or more relevant at this particular time, then we just had to drop it and move on to the next thing. And that wasn't really very satisfactory to me. I really enjoy,
I bet.
identifying, what the next steps are, and then working out how we can do those next steps. So I ended up leaving that company, and I went solo for a while. So I just became an independent consultant, and it's fair to say that that wasn't very easy to do. And one of the reasons is that if you're working with big industry, they actually don't really like working with sole traders, because there's just too much scope for things to go wrong. If you get sick, or you're unable to work, or whatever, or you get sidetracked into some other piece of contracting over here, then what happens to their project? So I ended up having to set up a small company, and had several people working with me over a few years. And I did that for, I guess, about 6 years when I was in the UK. until I was offered the job in Australia.
Brilliant stuff. Before we go to Morgan with some questions, so maybe what really, really fascinates you about diabetes and diabetes care? And did you over the years prior to your roles and that, did you know many people with diabetes and have many connections and network with people with diabetes? Or was it when you went to do your placement, that's where you kind of got involved in it?
I didn't know lots of people, but when I and it's it's easy to say things with hindsight, but when I reflect on who I've known over my life with diabetes, there have been some formative experiences. So when I was at school, at secondary school, one of my best friends had type 1 diabetes. I didn't understand it at the time. I don't think many people did. She was, definitely a bit different to the rest of us. She had to go off and have injections now and again, and we didn't really understand why or what that was about. We thought that, she needed to, watch what she ate and so on. But every now and again, she would need to have, lots of sugary foods. Obviously, she was dealing with a hypo, but we didn't understand that. So there were lots of things that set her apart from other people, and like I said, she was one of my best friends. So I, I found that, I had sympathy for her, that, there was clearly a very difficult condition that she was living with, but I just didn't really understand it well enough. And she used to have to, keep her insulin in the fridge and didn't always get to go and do everything that other people got to do. So there were clearly some aspects of, how diabetes was affecting her quality of life that, it was very difficult for her to live with at that time. Going back further than that, my grandmother died when I was just less than 2 years old, so I don't remember her. And she was a very strong woman, apparently, but got sick and ended up in hospital where they diagnosed diabetes. So she was quite elderly and ended up dying in hospital. And as I was growing up, there was talk that, that had been undiagnosed, like she'd been living with that diabetes for quite a while. It was undiagnosed. And there was
Wow.
sort of a sense that she'd been taken away too soon from us. So, like I say, I was very young, and, we're going back 50 years here. So, it's a long time ago. But
Absolutely.
I
And
guess I had.
was it type one, was it?
No, I suspect it was type 2.
Okay.
She was in her 80s at that
Yeah,
time.
yeah,
But I don't know.
yeah. No.
But I guess I kind of lived with a sense when I was growing up that my grandmother should have been around a lot longer, and it was and
Course.
it might have been diabetes that took her away from us, and I don't know really.
I'm
And
sure
then when
now
I
she'll be
was
look. I'm sure now she'll be looking down and really like made up with the career you've gone down. So yeah, she'll be incredibly proud.
Thank
And also like you said, over the years you've connected with different people.
you.
Do you have many people in your line of work now that have diabetes? I know you connect with Renza a lot, and obviously she's got type 1. But do you have many connections with people that you're working with that have diabetes?
I guess I know a lot of people with diabetes, and I don't really think about it anymore. It's,
Yeah,
it's
it's just
like,
normal. Yeah.
do you know women? Well, yes. Do
Exactly.
you know people in their 30s? Yes, probably. I just don't really think, I don't define them by that. And I think there's probably more people with diabetes, in my life and in my working life than many people would have, just for the nature of what I do. I think I come across people all the time, and obviously, there's lots of health professionals working in the field who also have diabetes. You don't necessarily know that when you first meet them. It becomes apparent later on. And I meet lots of people at conferences, of course, as well.
Amazing stuff. Thank you so much, Jane. We're going to head over to Morgan. She's over in the States, and she's going to ask you some questions about your role as a director of ACBRD, for anyone wondering what that means. We'll delve into that now.
Thanks, Tom.
Hello, Morgan here.
Hi, Mo. Hi, Morgan.
First, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us already. It's been great. But I do want to kind of dive into, your role as director at ACBRD. And for those who don't know, that's the Australian Centre for Behavioural Research in Diabetes, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Yes. And so if you could just kind of tell us a little bit more about the center and your role as foundation director.
Okay, thank you. So the centre was set up in 2010. It's a partnership between Diabetes Victoria, which is the state-based organisation.
Hello?
James, I think we've just
Apologies,
lost you.
sorry. I think, somehow
Sorry,
my.
I pressed the wrong button. I do apologize.
It's always Tom's
couldn't hear
fault.
anything.
It is always my fault. Blame
You
me.
muted
Sorry,
me,
James.
Tom. How dare you?
I was about to retweet to say James live right now, and I pressed the wrong button. I do apologize. Sorry.
So
Carry on.
just don't
Where
let it
did we
happen
get
again,
to?
Tom.
We've been doing this 8 weeks, and I've never done that once. I do apologize.
Morgan, where did you hear up to?
I think you had only said the first like two sentences.
Okay.
Basically, that it had been established in 2010 and it's a partnership between, and that's where I
Diabetes.
lost you.
Okay, so between Diabetes Victoria, which is the state-based organisation representing and supporting people with diabetes, and here in Victoria, and Deakin University. So I was invited to take up this role. So it was really the brainchild of Diabetes Victoria. The CEO at the time was Greg Johnson, who latterly became CEO of Diabetes Australia. And I think Diabetes Victoria had seen that the Cancer Council had a Centre for Behavioural Research in Cancer. And that it was putting a lot of emphasis on what it's like to live with cancer and what the support needs of people with cancer are. And so he thought, well, we need that in diabetes. And so I was offered the position here. So I came out to Australia to take that up. And so 12 years ago, it was just me. But within the first few months, I was able to recruit some amazing talent into our centre. Several of those people are still with us 12 years later, which I think is testament to the kind of work that we do, the passion that we have for it, and the team culture that we've enjoyed over many years. So we now have a team of 16 people, both researchers, staff and students, PhD students. And also, we have amazing support from administration and communication colleagues. And what else can I tell you about it? So we do research into so many different aspects of diabetes. So I can't say all diabetes, but we cover a lot of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. We're starting to do a bit more in gestational diabetes. We've done research with adolescents, with young adults. We haven't done so much with older adults, but certainly with adults generally. We look into all sorts of issues, which I think you've mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast. So, emotional and mental health, social stigma, the language we use in diabetes, hypoglycemia, the impacts of treatments and technologies on quality of life, and so on. So, there's lots of different areas that we look into.
That is absolutely amazing. And I mean, I can't imagine like watching a center and company like that just like grow from the very start to like what it is now and everything that has been accomplished there. Like it's so cool. And I just
Thank
kind
you.
of want to talk a little bit about like the accomplishments like you've had ranking in the top 0.2% for in research for type 1 and type 2, and publishing stuff like 210 plus articles is what my note says, and several book chapters. And I just, that's amazing. Like, what did you, would you mind talking a little bit about that and kind of like what keeps you going in that and how you just are able to find all that information? And I don't know, it's just incredible.
Well, I mean, you flatter me, I think. It's what academics do, I guess. So I don't think I'm that unusual in any of those achievements. If you look at many of my medical colleagues working in diabetes, they'll actually probably have more publications than I have. It comes about through working in a team that's highly productive, really engaged in what we do. And we also have lots of excellent collaborations around the world as well. So actually, it kind of happens by itself these days, in the sense that, I'm not trying to make certain things happen or trying to publish more papers. There's, I've got a to-do list sitting in front of me saying that I've got about six manuscripts at the moment that I need to be looking through, and they've been sitting there for a couple of weeks now. So, it's just the case that everyone's getting on with, amazing research that we've developed between us, and then there's, the call to get the papers out there and communicate that with people to make sure that the information that we're generating, the new knowledge that we're generating, is shared as widely as possible so that we can influence diabetes care and the outcomes for people with diabetes.
Do you have any research projects you have going on at the moment that you'd like to talk about that kind of stand out?
Gosh, they all stand out, I guess. We've been doing, oh gosh, we're doing one at the moment that I don't have any results for yet, but I'm very excited about it. We've actually been following the lead of what's been done in the UK around the James Lind Alliance, and we've been asking people with diabetes here what are their research priorities for the future. So we've been, trying to steer them down. Don't just tell us that you want the cure. We know that, and that's not our area of research. So there's not a lot that we can do to help with that. But what is it that would make life better with diabetes? So we've been doing, large scale survey work. We've been working with people with diabetes to understand their, their priorities for the future, and we're getting to a point now where we're going to be having some answers to those questions in the next couple of months, and I think we'll probably be getting a paper published later this year. So we're very excited about that. It's a relatively small project in the scheme of things, but it's something that's going to probably shape the work that we do for the next decade here in our centre. So that work's being led by Dr. Crystal Hendricks, our deputy director, and we're very excited about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely, I love that. That's great.
And,
I
may,
hope.
and maybe if anyone wants to press the blue button at the bottom, if there's any particular things that are interest to you that the guys could do. Or explore in the future, and like Jane said, the next decade, maybe put your thoughts there, and we can bring that into discussion as well.
Yeah, and again, if anybody has questions for our guests, feel free to press the microphone and come on and speak. But I know that Chris also has some questions for you about hypoglycemia, behavior change, and stuff like that. So I'm gonna go ahead and hand it off to him.
Hi, Professor Jane.
Hi, Chris. Just Jane will be fine, thanks.
I've actually been following you for quite a while on Twitter, so I almost feel like I know you a little bit. Not a bad thing, but but definitely a lot of the research that you've been doing about hypoglycemia and impacts on quality of life, and especially in people who are using insulin, the fear of hypoglycemia that that can develop, especially after a bad episode or two, is something that's really sort of fascinated me. I mean, I'm hypo unaware. I've had in my life probably 4 or 5 incidents of loss of consciousness, including full-blown seizures as a result of hypos, and that was before I had access to a continuous glucose monitor and all the other phenomenal tools that we have now. But could you talk a little bit about some of the effects that you've seen with the advent of technology and the positive effects it can have on people's confidence and maintaining better control while still avoiding hypos?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about all your experiences, Chris, but yeah, hypoglycemia is a fascinating area in how people, you know, how can we prevent hypoglycemia? That's obviously a behavioral challenge. How do people cope with hypoglycemia? How do they cope with their fear around it? How does it impact on their quality of life? So there are so many, you know, I appreciate very much that this is something that you live with, but from an academic perspective, it's a series of fascinating questions that need, you know, more information, more knowledge around them. So there's actually a lot of interest in hypoglycemia over the last few years. We've been collaborating with researchers in Europe on a project called HypoResolve, which is a massive European Union funded study involving something like 23 academic partners across many countries. And there's 8 work packages or sort of areas of work in that. And one of those is focused on the psychology of diabetes. And I'm co-leading that with Professor Franz Power in Denmark. And through that project, we've been able to do a series of studies that have focused on different types of diabetes. So we did systematic reviews looking at the impact of hypoglycemia on quality of life among adults with type 1 diabetes, adults with type 2, amongst adolescents, amongst family members. And then we've also done qualitative research that's where we've asked people what's important for their quality of life and then how hypoglycemia is affecting that. And we've then lastly gone on to quantify some of that with validated or valid measures of the impact of hypoglycemia on quality of life, again, in all of those different groups. So it's been a big and complex undertaking, and we're now sort of starting to shed some more light on this area. But it's essentially, I mean, I probably can't go into all of that today, but just looking, you know, a bit more into the issues for adults with type 1 diabetes, it's probably, as you might expect, as we already kind of know from the impact of diabetes generally on quality of life, that of course hypoglycemia can impact on, you know, people's relationships, on their social life, on their work and studies, on their, you know, their sleep. I think that's been that hasn't been recognized as much as it should have been over the years, that of course hypoglycemia affects people's sleep. If they're waking up in the middle of the night hypo and having to spend, you know, several minutes or even, you know, a couple of hours dealing with hypoglycemia, then of course it's going to affect their sleep and their productivity the next day. And so what we've also been able to do in this study is work with our colleagues in another work package 5, which is led by Professor Prateek Chowdhury at Leicester in the UK, on a study called Hypermetrics. And so what we're doing in, or what Prateek and our medical colleagues are doing in that study is doing an observational study of people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And of those with type 1, half of them have impaired awareness of hypoglycemia. And we're following those people up over a 10-week period using continuous glucose monitoring so that we're prospectively seeing what their hypoglycemia profiles look like over those 10 weeks. And we've also designed an app that's been led by one of our PhD students, Uffe Soholm. That app is basically enabling us to ask people every day and sometimes several times a day how they're feeling. So what's their mood like? What's their productivity like? Did they sleep well? How much energy they've got? All of these questions are on scales. They're not just yes or no answers. But all of that is going to give us the opportunity to really go in depth on understanding not just, you know, does hypoglycemia affect quality of life, and not just does a severe hypo affect quality of life more than what's traditionally been called a mild hypo. We're increasingly calling that self-treated hypoglycemia because it doesn't seem necessarily that there's anything mild about having to deal with hypoglycemia on a daily basis. But what it's going to do for the first time is enable us to understand how severe a hypo, so how deep, if you like, if you think about blood glucose levels going low, how low do you need to go, and for how long does that need to occur for before it has an impact on someone's quality of life in a particular area, say their general mood or their productivity or their sleep. You know, if you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and deal with a hypo in 10 minutes and go back to sleep, maybe it doesn't impact on your quality of life very much. But, you know, does it take 20 minutes, half an hour, an hour? What is that duration that actually starts to have a knock-on effect on people's quality of life? So those are some of the questions that we're grappling with at the moment to really shed more light on this area of how hypoglycemia affects people's quality of life. And we'll have some more information about that available later this year and into next year.
That's absolutely absolutely fascinating. I mean, I know personally when I have a a mild, I guess, hypo or a self-treated hypo, I might, you know, dip into using milligrams per deciliter into the 60s. So a hair below target, but not super low. I honestly, a lot of the times, don't even necessarily consider it a bad thing necessarily, since I know that people without diabetes often dip into those numbers without any adverse effects. Between you guys and the more clinical side, looking at even potentially adjusting time and range recommendations or anything along those lines, based on the research that you're doing, if you know it's okay to dip a little bit below what the current target is, and that might be taken into consideration in evaluating the outcomes of various clinical treatments and stuff.
Yeah, we don't have recommendations to make at the moment about that, and I think that there's a lot that needs to go into the thinking around those recommendations. So obviously, people, you know, in real life do what works for them, but what we're also aware of is that sometimes people don't have appropriate concern about hypoglycemia. So we hear a lot about fear of hypoglycemia, and that's the most sort of common emotional reaction, if you like, to glucose levels. But what we're increasingly interested in is actually avoidance of hyperglycemia, and basically people's preference for actually being on the low side rather than on the higher side. And that might make sense to a lot of people that, well, of course, you know, we don't want high glucose levels because they lead to long-term complications. But if people are actively reducing their glucose levels to, you know, to be sort of somewhat on the dangerous side, if you like, of low, and not appropriately concerned about those low levels, then we do have some concerns about that, because continually running glucose levels on the low side means that people reduce, people lose their awareness of their symptoms of hypoglycemia, which means that hypoglycemia can come on really quickly with very little warning, and very soon someone can be, you know, in trouble with their hypoglycemia. And if they're doing something that involves, you know, driving or machinery or, you know, something, you know, even just making a cup of tea in the morning, you know, and carrying a hot kettle around, that, you know, that can be a problematic. So we do need to, you know, watch out for how people think about hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia, and how they're coping with their concerns, or indeed if they don't have concerns about these issues, then we need to be looking into that a bit more. And there's certainly quite a bit of research that's going on around that area at the moment. So we've done work on the HypoCompass study, where we put in place a brief psychoeducational program to support people to think about the hypoglycemia, the symptoms, when it happens for them, and so on. So not so much an education session where they're being taught about hypoglycemia as a thought-provoking session where they're asked to consider their own hypoglycemia and when it happens for them and what they're aware of in terms of their symptoms and whether they can identify any patterns in how that happens. And similarly, although much more intensively, the HARPDOC study is being published at the moment, and that was presented last year at the European conference by Professor Stephanie Amiel. And in HARPDOC, they've taken a very intensive approach to supporting people who have already had all other technologies and treatment options offered to them, and they're still struggling with hypoglycemia. And the premise of that study is really that, you know, nothing else is working for these people, and it may be something around their thinking traps around hypoglycemia that is stopping them from, or that's leading to their hypoglycemia. And so we need to retrain the way we think about hypoglycemia in order to prevent it. And they've got some very promising findings from that study coming out now as well. But it's an incredibly intensive approach. So I think the next step here that we're starting to talk about with Stephanie's group is, and with many other people actually, is, you know, will it be an intensive approach that's needed, or might something briefer be possible? So the next step is really to kind of put these two things in this in one study to compare them, to see, you know, what is it that works and for whom.
I don't know about anybody else. I have known people who prefer to run themselves very, very low, in some cases dangerously low. I had a friend who was actually married to a coworker of mine when I was at university, who had type 1 and would frequently walk around with blood glucose levels in the low twos, in, you know, around 40 milligrams per deciliter for people who use that measurement system. And I was always terrified that, you know, I was going to be out with this guy and he was going to pass out and have a seizure or whatever, even just hanging out with a few people having having drinks after work or something like that when he would show up. It was it almost, you know, stressed me out worrying about him.
Yeah, it's a real challenge, both for the person, you know, who's experiencing that hypoglycemia, for their family members. Often family members actually recognize hypoglycemia before the person who's having the hypoglycemia. So that can cause some tensions in the family, because, you know, another person will say, I think, you know, you may be having a hypo here, and the person doesn't necessarily experience that or want to be told that at that particular time. So there's a lot that goes into preventing hypos in terms of, you know, both that thinking process, in terms of, you know, where your priorities are in avoiding hyperglycemia or hypoglycemia. Hopefully most people are somewhere in the middle and trying to maintain that appropriate time in range. But then there's also, you know, other issues around preventing hyperglycemia, such as not really being able to or not feeling able to do another round of preventing hypos. So just feeling kind of burnt out by continually having to deal with this kind of roller coaster of glucose levels. Other people we've spoken to have actually, you know, told us, well, they just dislike, you know, all the available glucose treatments. And, you know, so they really struggle with, you know, treating a hypoglycemia appropriately and in a timely fashion, because, you know, they're probably using, you know, treatments that are not that effective. They're more likely to be, you know, eating, you know, some chocolate to try and manage it rather than, you know, throwing back some jelly beans, which they don't particularly like.
Well, jelly beans are preferable to the glucose tabs. I think we can all identify with a chalky, nasty glucose tablet.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess the point I'm making is, you know, that I think health professionals often just assume that, you know, they prescribe that, well, if you're having a hypo, you should take this many glucose tabs. Well, it's just not as straightforward as that. There's actually a range of ways in which people, you know, try to prevent a hypo or try to manage, you know, a glucose that's starting to trend downwards. And not all treatments, you know, are as effective as each other. And people have strong preferences about these things.
Jane, we've got a few comments on the hashtag diabetes chat and questions before we maybe talk about diabetes stigmas. Richard says, enjoying a chat with Jane at the diabetes chat. Looking forward to some work being done on burnout and interstate collaboration. Michelle says, enjoying listening to the diabetes chat and full of admiration for Jane and all the work she does at ACBRD. And Flipper says, the inconvenience of hypos, feel the worry I might go hypo is also as annoying as being hypo, which I think is massive, isn't it? It absolutely is. And a quick question from Michelle, question for Jane. Is there more awareness and recognition of the psychological support needs for people with diabetes? And is there more funding coming through to support research in that area? And how much international collaboration is there on this?
Yeah, great questions, Michelle. Yes, I think there's a lot more awareness and recognition now than there was even just a few years ago. In some ways, I think maybe the pandemic has even helped with this. There's been a lot more focus in the last couple of years on mental health generally. And so it's made it more obvious to, you know, many more people that, well, if you're, you know, struggling with something like the pandemic, then, you know, people who are living with chronic conditions in their everyday lives and have been doing so for many years, of course, there would be some mental health challenges around that. So I think there is a growing awareness and recognition of that. In terms of the funding coming through, certainly in this area that I've been talking about hypoglycemia, there seems to be a lot of interest at the moment. So as I've mentioned, we're, you know, involved in this large European study that was funded to the tune of 20 odd million euros 4 years ago. And it's a massive undertaking and far bigger than I've mentioned today. The psychology is actually quite a small aspect of it. But essentially, this is a large collaboration across Europe of academics, health professionals, people with diabetes, and industry all coming together to answer the question of how are we going to resolve hypoglycemia. So recognizing, you know, 100 years after the discovery of insulin, that hypoglycemia is still a massive problem that we have not yet really done enough to deal with. And obviously there's technologies coming through all the time, but they are not a panacea. And we definitely need to be doing more to understand how to prevent it. So that hypermetric study is really important that's coming through. But even just in the last, last year there was a conference organized by in the US by the National Institute of Health, focused on impaired awareness of hypoglycemia. And now there's a call out. In fact, it closed yesterday in Europe. So on Monday, and that was about again understanding and identifying what it is that we can do that will address impaired awareness of hypoglycemia and understanding how to assess that better. So over the last few weeks, there's been a flurry of researchers all around the world collaborating with each other to pull together their submissions for that big call. And I'm aware of at least three or four that are going in. So, yes, there's a lot of collaboration going on across the world on this particular issue.
I think following that, Flipper on the diabetes chat hashtag, Jane, hi, how important does you feel for academia, to be on social media and spread research outcomes and papers to people living with diabetes? And what are some of the positives and negatives for you?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it's incredibly important. I think Twitter gets a bad rap these days for being a place where, you know, there's bad behaviour and it can be very challenging and very divisive sometimes. But on the whole, I think of it like a playground. You know, you just need to be, you know, engaged in appropriate behaviour in a playground. And I think you need to be doing the same on social media too. So overall, I find it a very positive experience to be able to share our research and research that other people do on Twitter. I find a lot of useful information myself through that medium as well. That I wouldn't necessarily come across. You know, it's just so hard to keep on top of all the journals, all the publications that are going on around the world. And so, you know, on a daily basis, I can just have a quick scroll through and people are highlighting their papers. And so if you're, you know, following certain people, you're keeping up to date with things that you, you know, you might not have found for another few weeks or even a few months or whatever. So I do think it's really useful from that perspective, from an academic researcher to another academic researcher, if you like. But I also think it's incredibly important way of us as researchers being able to share our findings with the broader diabetes community and to engage with the community around these issues. So I really enjoy you know, the little chats and threads that we have with each other, and you know, and I enjoy and get real insights from you know, looking through the tweets that people with diabetes share with each other, not just necessarily with researchers, but amongst themselves. Maybe that's lurking, I don't know. But I do find it very insightful to sort of read what people are currently thinking about, feeling, and so on, the kind of everyday ups and downs of living with diabetes.
Thank you, Jane. Great questions that Flipper and Michelle. So guys, we're going to go into our final section of the evening where we're going to talk about stigmas associated to diabetes. And when we touched upon this in week three, our second guest speaker with Renza, we played this short video. And I want to play it again. It was during the diabetes stigma campaign for Diabetes Australia few years ago now, but I think the video is very relatable. And if anyone wants to hashtag diabetes chat or come on and speak about diabetes stigma or share or ask questions to Jane, this is your chance to come on. So let's play the video and we'll continue the chat.
Could you do that in the bathroom?
That's amazing.
It looks like diabetes on a plate.
Should you be eating that?
You really should have taken better care of yourself.
Just incredible. And the end credit says, nobody chooses diabetes. End diabetes blame and shame.
So let's talk a little bit about social stigmas. What are social stigmas, Jane? And sort of what are the social stigmas that are commonly attached to people with having diabetes? And what, from your research and from your knowledge and insights, what are the sort of impacts of diabetes stigmas? What can this have, the effect, the knock-on effect on people in terms of maybe their emotional health or self-care or other things?
Thanks, Tom. So stigma is a negative social judgment based on a feature. So, you know, in the case of diabetes, that can be a negative social judgment about diabetes as a condition, or about how someone might be managing it, or about what people with diabetes must be like. And stigma can be both experienced and also perceived. So that can be in the form of blame and judgment and stereotyping, being treated differently or feeling like you're being treated differently. And it can lead to rejection, exclusion, discrimination. So, you know, the breadth of experience there is really, you know, quite staggering, from a little bit of, well, someone just said the wrong thing, or maybe I misinterpreted what they meant by that, to actually feeling or actually being actively discriminated because of your condition. And I think one of the most harmful aspects of stigma, aside from obviously out and out exclusion and rejection and discrimination, is that stigma can be internalized. So some people with who are experiencing stigma actually start to believe that themselves, and experience self-stigma, or, you know, self-shaming, blaming themselves for this issue, whatever that might be. So I think this is a big problem. We started researching this just over a decade ago now, when we identified, it was actually comments. So there was a newspaper article about diabetes and really about type 2 diabetes and the obesogenic environment. So the problems of trying to prevent both obesity and type 2 diabetes in an environment that is saturated with unhealthy foods and drinks and environments that are not conducive with physical activity. And all of that being a problem that society needs to solve and that governments need to solve. And it, this not being a problem specifically or exclusively of personal responsibility. And that newspaper article was written by a very well-known and highly esteemed diabetes specialist. And he knew what he was talking about in that article. But the responses that came in online to that article were from the general public, were really absolutely awful in terms of how blaming and shaming they were of people with diabetes and people with obesity, that these were just, you know, fat, lazy so-and-sos who brought it on themselves. Why should we help these people if they won't help themselves? why should we be spending our taxpayer dollars? You know, this is just all a problem of willpower, essentially, and that these people don't deserve our help. And that got us thinking about the extent to which this apparent stigma in society was actually real, or is it just, you know, a small collection of people who are just nasty in online comments to a newspaper, or was this actually more widespread? And how was it impacting on people with diabetes? So we did a systematic review of the literature. We didn't find very much at that time. And so we then did interviews with people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And we identified all the things that I've just mentioned: blame, stereotyping, discrimination, self-stigma, shame. And we identified that there were many sources of that stigma. So this was coming from the media. It was also coming from health professionals, sadly. It was also coming from family and friends who didn't understand diabetes well enough. And importantly, it was also coming from the campaigns promoted by diabetes organisations. So very well-meaning campaigns that were trying to encourage people to, be healthier, get out walking, these kinds of things. But it was also the kinds of campaigns that are about preventing type 2 diabetes that are suggesting that, you know, if you just did a bit more, then you could prevent your diabetes. And we've seen in more recent years as well, there's lots of campaigns that are now associating sugar with complications. And so these messages are very harmful. They're very simplistic. They're not accurate at all in terms of the links between, you know, sugar and complications. There's a very complicated story there, and it should not be depicted by a simple image on a poster that gives everyone the impression that people with diabetes have brought their complications on themselves by eating too much sugar. This is just not true, and it's not helpful. And it's actually very harmful. So that's, I guess, how we got into researching diabetes stigma and why we're still doing lots of research in this area. Coming on to your question about the impacts of stigma on people with diabetes, there are many impacts. It's very difficult for us to identify what's an impact and what's an association. So when we do research in this area, we use questionnaires. These are known as, you know, person-reported outcome measures or patient-reported outcome measures, PROMs. And we've designed questionnaires that specifically address the issue of diabetes stigma. And then, of course, we also need to use other questionnaires to assess things like diabetes distress, diabetes self-care, confidence in managing diabetes, and so on. And these are also self-reported, and they're reported at the same time. So it's very difficult to unpick whether this is just a cross-sectional association between these two constructs or outcomes, or whether one is leading to the other. Now, logic would suggest that one is leading to the other, and in some we've got fewer studies that are longitudinal, but we have identified in some prospective studies that stigma can impact on people's willingness to use insulin. So for people with type 2 diabetes, that diabetes stigma can impact on people's willingness to use insulin, and that willingness translates 12 months later into not, or that lack of willingness rather predicts people not using insulin 12 months later. So there's actually, from the small amount of prospective research we've got, some quite powerful effects that we're seeing of diabetes stigma on the ways in which people are prepared to manage their diabetes. But as I say, most of our research is coming from cross-sectional associations. And in that research, we're seeing that increased diabetes stigma is associated with increased diabetes distress, lower confidence in managing diabetes, lower diabetes self-care, also, and that diabetes self-stigma is also associated with those outcomes, perhaps more so. We're also seeing impacts on more sort of health outcomes, if you like, around the frequency of seeing a diabetes health professional, or the frequency of having an HbA1c check.
Yeah, definitely.
And when we've done qualitative studies with younger adults with type 2 diabetes several years ago now, we found that those young adults didn't want to go to clinic because they were concerned about the health professionals judging them for having a high HbA1c. So they'd already experienced this in a previous clinic, or, you know, at a previous appointment, and they just didn't want to be having that experience again. And that, so they therefore decided not to attend their appointments. So these are really powerful effects, actually, that are preventing people from managing their diabetes as well as they might, from seeking out the support from health professionals that we know is important for them in terms of being able to manage it, a condition as complicated as diabetes that you need to manage for the rest of your life. So we're very concerned about these issues, and that we have it's a very complex problem, and it's going to require complex, multifaceted solutions. So it's not just as simple as saying, you know, we just need to stop diabetes stigma. Well, how do we stop diabetes stigma? We need to change the campaigns. We need health professionals, you know, to be more supportive and empathic towards people with diabetes, and not to be judging them and blaming them. We need friends and family to be more understanding and more supportive, and to appreciate that people with diabetes, by and large, know what they're doing in managing their diabetes, and that they're making decisions and choices that are appropriate for them at that point in time. So there's just lots of different issues around diabetes stigma that are going to require a lot of efforts from a lot of different people, both, you know, in the home setting, in the healthcare setting, at a policy level, and we've got a lot more work to be doing in this space.
Incredible stuff, Jane. Very powerful. Yesterday, I tweeted some statistics. So for type 1, I'll just read a couple out. 67% of people, because I have type 1 diabetes, some people judge me if I eat sugary foods or drink. 55%, some people assume it's my fault I have type 1 diabetes. 49%, I feel embarrassed about what people might think if I need help with a hypo. And we talked about hypoglycemia before. And then going on to type 2, because I think it's very important to talk about type 2. I think primarily a lot of people of our listeners are type 1, but it's very important to talk about type 2 diabetes. And over the next couple of weeks, hopefully we can talk more about it and hopefully get some people who have type 2 diabetes to share their experiences. 52% of type 2s, because I have type 2 diabetes, some people assume I must be overweight or have been in the past. 37%, because I have type 2 diabetes, some people judge me for my food choices. And 33%, there is blame and shame surrounding type 2 diabetes. So, yeah, very powerful statistics there. You know what you were saying about when you do your surveys, how many respondents do you normally, or participants, do you normally get in the, in them sort of surveys?
Oh gosh, it really depends on the study and, you know, what we're aiming for. I don't have the figures to hand. Oh yes, I do. So these statistics that you've just been citing are from 900 adults with type 1 diabetes in Australia and over 1,000 adults with type 2 diabetes in Australia. So pretty large numbers of people took part in our MILES 2 study in which we used these diabetes stigma questionnaires But, you know, it varies from study to study. Sometimes we've only got, you know, a couple of hundred people in the study. Sometimes we've got a couple of thousand people.
Yeah, absolutely. A few comments on the hashtag as well. Fascinating stuff, Jane. Dennis, really enjoying this. Hits home. Thank you, Dr. Jane. Dr. Elizabeth Holmes, would be interesting to examine internalized stigma in newly diagnosed people. That'd be very interesting. Andreas, diabetes chat. I have a feeling that in Germany there is nearly no stigmatization of type 1 diabetes, or at least in my experience, whereas USA Twitter seems to be more stigmatized, question mark. Are those affected dependent on the country you live in? And if so, why?
Yeah, I don't know anything about diabetes stigma in Germany. I would love to be looking at that. We have started to look internationally at stigma. So there's actually work going on in all sorts of countries around diabetes stigma at the moment. Off the top of my head, I can think of the USA, Japan, Singapore, Denmark. Anyway, there's several countries that are doing research. New Zealand has done some too. And our questionnaires are being translated into many languages now, and that work is ongoing by many people around the world. So this is not dependent on us at our centre doing this work. Any other researchers in the field can be doing this, and many of them are. When I looked into the research that we had from Australia, New Zealand and Singapore, now Australia and New Zealand are obviously quite similar countries. Singapore is a bit different. And I've also looked at the differences between the type 1 and type 2 groups there. There are some similarities and differences, both across diabetes types and across countries. So I think it's going to be really interesting to have a more international study, a bit like we had with the Dawn study a few years ago, where they showed that discrimination on average was affecting about 20% of people with diabetes, but it was actually very different in different countries. So I think discrimination is a very specific and extreme aspect of stigma. So I think it would be really interesting to be able to do a large international study looking at stigma in people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and gestational diabetes for that matter, across the world. I'd be really excited to do that, and I'm already having some discussions with a few people about how we might go about doing that.
I think it's just such an important topic. I've said it many times on our diabetes chat that I've had diabetes 16 years and only recently started to feel a bit confident about my diabetes, and many years of probably burnout and trying to ignore it, probably embarrassed and worried of what people think or say. And even when you've heard them say sort of comments like that video where you said, oh, are you meant to have that piece of cake, or them sort of comments, or like you say, when you go to healthcare professional appointments and you're worried about how they may, some experiences of how they judge you on your numbers or whatnot. But yeah, very powerful stuff. If anyone would like to join as speaker and come on and ask Jane a question while we've still got her, please feel free to. Dawny and Dennis, I know you're on the line. If you've got any questions for Jane, please come forward. Or like I said, if anyone else wants to come forward and ask a question about diabetes stigma, please come on and come and ask.
Good day to all of you. My name is Dennis. A bit nervous. A bit
Hi,
emotional.
Dennis.
It's a bit emotional. And it touched home. I've been a diabetic for about 52 years now. Juvenile, I've been injecting myself since then. Just come back from a heart surgery about 3 months ago. And Not easy managing diabetes with the heart problems, but that's okay. Anyways, I have a question for you, doctor, please, if I may. It seems to me that I'm a little bit paranoid before I go to bed. I mean, right now with the 24-hour launches in Quebec, Canada, my 24-hour insulin, I'm still trying to get a handle on it, but it's like every time I go to bed, I have this deep-seated fear of just slipping away. And it's kind of screwing things up for me.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Dennis. It sounds like that's a really difficult challenge for you to be living with. I can't comment on your personal situation there, unfortunately. But what I would advise, if at all possible, is for you to go and speak with your health professionals about this, because it's clearly distressing you a lot, and it's very challenging to live with that kind of fear that you're expressing right now. So I think there is more that can be done to support you with both the technology, but also with the psychological support to deal with this.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Dennis. I wish you well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. That was very emotional to come on and chat to us. Take my hat off to you, my friend. Like Jane said, there are many people out there can help, healthcare professionals, or even just talking to someone, whether it's through this or other means of social media or in person. Just connect with people and talk and share experiences. It's never too late. And someone sent me a message the other day, said it's never too late to connect. And go speak to who you need to. But thank you for coming on and sharing that. Very, very powerful. Chris, Morgan, any thoughts?
I would like to jump in. I think now is a really good time to mention that we are all going through this together, and that if at any point anybody needs to talk about anything, I can't speak for everybody else, but I know my DMs are always open for anybody that just needs to talk and rant about whatever they need to do, or whatever they need to. But yeah, if anything, my DMs are always open.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just jumping in to say there's also obviously a number of online avenues to vent and to get support, even from peers and people with diabetes. Obviously, this is one, but there's any number of communities, hashtags on Twitter, on Facebook, Reddit, other social media platforms, Discord. I'm in a number of diabetes Discord discussions, and people jump on with issues, and even just looking for someone to identify with what they're going through and get advice and find out what worked for other people. So even if for some reason, if you can't get what you need from a formal healthcare professional, that might be something to look into as well, if for nothing else than just to have someone to identify with what it is that you're going through.
May I say a little something? Is that okay?
Of course.
Okay, great. I'm being followed by I live in Quebec, and I'm up north, and I have a great team. It's a metabolic center, and I've got a doctor that is taking care of me, and I have a home doctor, and I have a cardiologist. But what I'm saying, I wanted to talk about the snapping, the other subject. I remember my girlfriend passed away, but anyways, there were times when we would argue passively, and she'd say, "It's time to test your glucose levels," and I would trust her enough I think in a relationship, when there's a diabetic, there has to be a certain level of trust, because I would trust her when she would tell me, you need to test yourself. And I would, and 99.9% of the time, she was right. And I just popped in the tablets, and away we go. We talked about the tablets. I prefer the tablets. You know, they're right by my bedside. And it only takes 10 minutes for me, so it's fine. It doesn't really screw up my sleeping. It just, you know, it just heightens my fear before I go to bed. That's what that does, you know. I take a lot of notes, and I learned that from my father, and I could sit here and talk to you guys for an hour, 2 hours, but that's not going to happen, because I'd rather listen. I'm a bit of a motor mouth, so thanks for listening.
Thank you, Dennis, for sharing, honestly, and you're welcome anytime, and shortly we'll be going into our open forum, and at that point it's an opportunity for everyone to just talk and share and connect and talk about your diabetes, ask questions, and just really connect with people all over the world. Maybe Jane, if we can just maybe take 5 more minutes, and then we'll conclude, really, because we really appreciate you coming on. Dr. Jill Carlton on the hashtag, fascinating as always, Jane. If you could wave a magic wand and insist on one change in the way healthcare is delivered in diabetes care, what would you wish for?
Such a great question, Jill.
Super question.
I wish I had a magic wand. I think, where do I start? There's so many things that I could wish for. Could I have 3 wishes?
we'll be the genie, and you can have 3 yeah. wishes. Go for it.
I think one way in which I would want healthcare to be delivered better is to be responsive to the needs of people with diabetes. So what I mean by that is that we have these systems of, you know, annual reviews or 3 monthly reviews, and everything is geared to being convenient to the system and not necessarily what is right for the person with diabetes at that time. So they feel often that they're just being called in to go through things because that's what the health professional wants, because that's what the system requires. I feel like we're getting somewhere actually in the pandemic with having opportunity, you know, greater opportunities for telehealth and so on, whereby there's kind of a greater recognition now that you can just sort of check in by phone or by a video consult. You don't necessarily have to, you know, spend hours getting to a clinic, waiting at a clinic, being seen and so on. So I think that's one way in which I would like to see things change for the better is, you know, people with diabetes just being able to check in with their health professionals when they feel that they, you know, want that support and need that support from the health professionals, rather than feeling like they're going for their checkup, you know, they're being monitored in some way. And then, of course, related to that, I really do wish that healthcare was delivered with far more empathy than it is currently. And I think it's a real shame that I know so many health professionals, and they are fantastic people, and they are working in quite challenging environments, so we shouldn't be too harsh on them. I think it's a very challenging profession to have. But I know that most health professionals get into healthcare because they want to help people, and yet somehow helping people becomes a slightly different thing, or it means different things to different people. So I think that quite often health professionals think they're helping people, but it's not actually what they're doing. And one of the ways in which they can be more responsive to the needs of people with diabetes is just to understand the condition, understand the people experiencing that condition a bit better, and use more empathetic language, be aware of the way in which their words matter to people. So we haven't talked about language today, but as you probably all know, you know, I feel very passionately about the the idea that our words really do reflect our attitudes and our beliefs, and show through those attitudes and beliefs show through in the way we talk. Now, that's not always, just down to the health professional. It's the society in which we're conditioned. It's what we're reading in journals. It's what we're reading in textbooks. It's how our, supervisors or more experienced colleagues are talking about diabetes, because that's the way it was done years ago. So there's a lot that needs to change or be appreciated about how language evolves over time and how we can improve things. And I think things really are starting to improve in this area after about a decade's worth of position statements all around the world on this issue. I think health professionals and many others are, starting to really appreciate the power that language has. And that is certainly, so it's a fairly slow magic wand, Jill. But I think we've been waving it for a while now. Many people, not just those of us who've been involved in writing the position statements, but I think there's many more people around the world, people with diabetes and health professionals alike, and researchers who are all vested in this area and feel that it has power to make a big difference to the lives of people with diabetes. So those are just two of the ways in which I would wave my magic wand. And I guess my third one would be to make sure that everyone has access to the education, whether that's, structured education or psychoeducation, and the support, the psychological support that they need for living a life with diabetes. So we know that it's really challenging for people to get access to psychologists. Very few psychologists specialize in diabetes, know enough about diabetes, so we need to change that. But, pragmatically, I appreciate that it's unlikely to be the case that everyone with diabetes would be able to see psychologists on a regular basis. But I do think it's worth aiming for all specialist diabetes centres to have a psychologist attached to them and be part of that team, because I think there's a lot of power in the fact that the psychologist is in the team having conversations with those other health professionals in the team and putting a psychological lens on what's going on. So even if you don't necessarily get to see the psychologist yourself, to know that your medical professionals and nursing professionals are being informed by psychological practice and research and theory, I think is really important and can make a big difference. We've seen that in the clinics in which it happens. So that would be my third wish. There's many, many others that I could choose as well. But from a purely sort of psychological perspective, those are the three things that I would like to change.
Some other comments on the chart, diabetes chart hashtag. Michelle, love the sound of the psychoeducation to go with the medical side of diabetes education, like self-coaching, getting over burnout, staying engaged and motivated long-term, coping skills. We need that toolbox. These are as important as carb counting, etc. 100%. Big love on that one, big heart. And there's a little thread going on between Crystalline asking about MDI users. How do you feel about injecting in public? Linking on the sort of discussion we had around stigmas and stuff. I know for me, I'm still to this day really nervous around just getting my injection pen out and injecting myself at the fear of what people would say or whatever. Crystalline's saying every now and then she'll do it at the table discreetly if she can. She's had an experience at a restaurant where staff come up to the table while mid-injecting and they're coming over and engaging. Dominique says I'm never bothered. I treat it as an opportunity to raise awareness about diabetes. Molly says
That's how she met her now husband. Wow. Over 20 years ago, without thinking twice at a restaurant, she whipped out her syringe and injected into her thigh. He says, I looked up and said, you're not afraid of needles, are you? And she says, I probably could have handled that better. And look, 20 years on, and you're still with your husband now, and whipping out your syringe. Wow, that's back in the day, isn't it? And Ariel says, I haven't been out to eat in 2 years, sad face, but used to shoot in public and all the time. I try not to be blatant about it, but I don't try and hide it. But I think the interesting thing is that everyone has different perspectives and opinions of it and deal with it in their own way, isn't it? But absolutely fascinating stuff, Jane. I'm sure we could talk for hours and hours. Maybe just before we leave, you mentioned about language and how people use words. What about the terminology diabetic? You're diabetic. What's your opinion? What's your feelings on that? Have you got anything to say on that? And how do people feel about that? Maybe getting involved in the hashtag diabetes chat. Do you like people saying you're diabetic, or should it be you're a person with diabetes? So, Jane, what's your thoughts on that?
I think it's one of these issues that sort of divides the community. Personally, as someone without diabetes, I think it's more respectful to refer to someone as a person with diabetes. My own view on that has been held since way back when I was doing my research assistant and PhD work 20 odd years ago. And people were almost exclusively referred to as diabetics in those days. And as psychologists, we were trying to help our health professional colleagues to understand diabetes from the perspective of the person living with it. And if you only think of a person as a diabetic, it's the first thing that you see or hear about them is diabetic. You don't think of them as a person with a family, a job, quality of life that they're trying to maintain. So for me, it was always about putting the person first and the diabetes second. And if you do that, then you're more likely to be able to help the person to integrate diabetes into their life in a way that is acceptable to them and manageable for them and successful for them. So that's why I prefer to refer to people as people with diabetes rather than as diabetics or patients. Same thing for patients, actually, as well, as I think that we spend very little time in the healthcare system. We're not, you know, people with diabetes are not patients all the time. They're only patients when they're in hospitals. And so we should just be referring to them as people with diabetes. But I do appreciate that this is an issue that divides the community and that there are many people with diabetes who call themselves diabetics, call other people diabetics, think that's okay for them. And I do think that may well be okay for them. But I would also suggest that they may well have been socialized into thinking of themselves in that way, and that it's always worth just taking a step back to think about whether you're really comfortable with that label. And there's nothing wrong with the label inherently. It's just about how it's used or what it stops people from thinking about, you know, in a holistic way, like I've just mentioned. So for me, I think it's more respectful and more useful for health professionals and researchers to be thinking about a person with diabetes rather than a diabetic. But I also think that this is a very small issue in the whole language matters area, and one that detracts from the conversation around all of the other inappropriate words that are around, words around compliance and control and disease and suffering and victims. And all of these words, I think, are far more problematic probably than the distinction between patient, diabetic and person with diabetes.
Fantastic stuff, Jane. It'd be interesting to see what everyone else's thoughts on that. If you want to get involved, please do. Hashtag, or we'll in the open forum, we can talk about it. Yeah, absolutely fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Jane, for this evening. You've been absolutely amazing. We've covered so much, and it's just been such a fascinating evening talking to you. And hopefully we'll keep connecting. I know you follow and you tweet different things, and but yeah, everyone go check out Jane, give her a follow, see out all her amazing publications that she's doing. And who knows, maybe in the next 6 months, a year or so, we can get Jane on and we can chat some more, because I just feel we could talk for hours, Jane.
I think we've just scratched the surface here, Tom, so I'd be delighted to come back another time.
Absolutely.
But, thank you and your co-hosts and everyone who's engaged today. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope it's been useful and interesting to everyone. But thanks very much for inviting me.
Bye-bye,
thank
doctor.
You very much.
Thank you.
And the sun's up now in Australia, so that's nice. We can start our day.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, and you can start your day. Any plans for today, Jane? What day are we? We're Tuesday over there now, aren't we?
We're on Tuesday, yes. I'm losing track. Lots of meetings.
I'm still in the past. Normally, when we do this space, we're in the UK, it gets to about midnight. And Chris always says to me, once we get over to... Then the next day he goes, look, you're in the future. And I'm like, yeah, and you guys are still in the past. But yeah, look at you, Jane, over there in sunny Australia, yeah, in the future. But yeah, I hope you have a lovely day. And honestly, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. Everyone interacting, listening, asking questions. It's just been amazing. And we'll keep in touch. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thank you, Jane.